Well, I wonder if there's a part of the world that you've never seen but would very much like to. Probably true of most of us, certainly true of me. Those of us privileged to live in England's green and pleasant land may well feel that we've got all we need within our own shores. And we are indeed blessed, aren't we, with an extraordinary variety of landscape and of natural surroundings in our comparatively small and compact space. But we haven't got everything. Have we? We haven't got a Grand Canyon. We haven't got a Niagara Falls. We haven't got a Table Mountain. We haven't got the steppes of Siberia. We haven't got South American rainforests. And the list could go on. And if you do have the opportunity to be in some such place, you may be someone who, when you get there, says, "Wow, that is fantastic. Never seen anything like that before. We don't have anything like that back at home." And yet you might even say, well, having said that, home at the end of the day is where I would rather be if I have to choose. And it's a bit like that for Daniel at the beginning of this 10th chapter of this remarkable book. We enter the last lap of the race as we begin chapter 10, because chapters 10 to 12, that's the remaining three chapters, really go together. They're divided into chapters in our Bibles, but really, they're all one big chunk. And chapter 10 is a bit like the introduction to a sermon, really. It's a rather long one, as introductions can be. The content really comes in chapters 11 and 12. But the introduction in chapter 10 is what we have before us this morning, and it is in itself very instructive. And as I think we'll find next week, a little harder to make sense of than the chapter that follows. But that's for next week. We find Daniel at the beginning in verse 4, on the 24th day of the first month, standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris. Now that must have been, to a Jew, rather as the Grand Canyon or the Niagara Falls might be to a Brit, the sight of the Tigris might have been a very impressive sight indeed, because he had no great river like that back at home. If you remember the story of Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5, the story of the Syrian general who gathers that there is a prophet in Israel through whom he can be cured of his leprosy. And when he goes to meet Elisha the prophet, Elisha says to him, "Yes, well," he actually sends a message, says, "You've just got to go and wash in the Jordan seven times, and then you'll be clean." And Naaman doesn't like this, because the Jordan is a piddling little river. He's got a proper one back home. Why can't he go and be washed there? Is what he says. And the answer is no. If you want to be clean, you need to get washed here. But it wasn't much of a river. The Tigris is magnificent. We had Australian friends staying with us a number of years ago. They were lent a little holiday cottage in Winchelsea on the south coast. Some of us will know Winchelsea. They were told there was a very nice beach there. These are Australians. They got there and they said, "Where is it?" And they saw these pebbles going down into the sea. They said, "That's not a beach." We never heard the last of it. Well, likewise, Daniel is looking now at a real river, the great river, the Tigris. And it's very impressive, but it reminds him at the same time that he is far from home. He is still in a foreign land. He and his fellow Israelites have been there for the best part of 70 years, but the time of the return has come in fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy. 70 years was going to be it. And 50,000 fellow Israelites have now trekked back to Jerusalem. We are, as the opening verse says, we're in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So we're talking something like 537 BC. But some have remained behind, and Daniel is one of them, possibly because he's too old to travel. He's probably in his late 80s, maybe a 90-year-old, but he's still occupying a significant place in the Babylonian kingdom, where his nation have been in exile for these decades. He is still there on the bank of the great river. It's fantastic, but it reminds him he is far away. And as he stands, he looks up in verse 5, and he is greeted, his eyes are greeted with the most extraordinary vision. A man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold, the finest gold, round his waist, his body like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs gleaming like burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. This is a vision that speaks. We're not into mysticism here, unintelligible, strange experiences. There is a vision, but there are words. And the dominant feature of this vision is the brilliance of the light. Chrysolite, a translucent precious stone, the light seems to come from inside. We've got lightning flashes in his face. We've got the flaming fire of his eyes. We've got burnished bronze in his arms and legs, highly polished, brilliant, and dazzling. They all convey, all these things convey light of the brightest and most dazzling kind. He is really trying to describe, of course, the indescribable. It is a vision, as somebody said, that pulsates with brightness and reverberates with sound, because there is sound as well. And in verse 6, the sound of his words is like the sound of a multitude. And of course, we want to know who this man is whom Daniel has seen. And our first thought probably is that this might be a pre-incarnate appearance of the second person of the Trinity, that this is the Son of God seen in his glory 500 plus years before his being born on earth, seen in his radiant glory. And certainly if you know the book of Revelation, you'll know that magnificent vision that the Apostle John has in the opening chapter, and he falls down before the one whom he sees as though dead. And many of the same elements in that description of the risen Jesus are found here. It is very similar, but it's not actually quite the same, and the differences are significant. There is really a closer parallel, if you want a parallel, with Ezekiel's vision in his opening chapter, where Ezekiel has a vision of the blazing chariot of the Lord. It conveys the presence of God, not itself divine, of course. But many of the things which are described here are also found in Ezekiel's vision. Why do we think this is not actually a vision of the Lord himself? Well, this man says in verse 11 that he has been sent to you. I've been sent to you. And that raises a question in our mind, I think, doesn't it? It's true that later on we'll know that wonderfully that God sent his own son into the world. But that's a rather different thing, and it's a long way off, and it's surprising language to find here if this person is truly divine. More to the point, in verse 13, it seems that he's somebody who needs help. He needs help in the struggle that he's involved with, because he has met resistance from an opposing power. Verse 13 reads, the prince of the kingdom of Persia, that's a kind of spiritual counterpart of the man in the vision. This prince, this spiritual force, withstood me 21 days. But, he says, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia. Well, does omnipotence have to call for help? We think not. And the help did come, but it was delayed for 3 weeks, and it couldn't get there earlier. He did come to Daniel's aid, but he was delayed in his coming for 3 weeks, bringing help in answer to Daniel's prayer. He couldn't get there earlier on. So this surely has to be some extraordinary angelic being that Daniel sees, rather than the Lord himself. And yet he's more radiant than Gabriel, whom we've met in an earlier chapter. He's more powerful, it seems, than Michael, one of the chief princes. And he is so close to the Lord of heaven and earth, and so instrumental in the Lord's purposes, that he himself is infused with the splendor and the power and the glory of the Lord he serves. So it is not surprising that we almost feel that Daniel is seeing God himself as he sees his servant. So this vision then sets the tone for this long introductory chapter, and four things can be seen to accompany it and to follow from it. And the first thing that we see here is the effect on Daniel himself, because this vision is overwhelming. It is an overwhelming vision. And more, in fact, is said about the effect on Daniel of what he sees than about the nature of the man he sees. The focus is much more on the effect on Daniel. We may be curious as to the nature of the vision. We're more likely to learn from the effect on the prophet. There are 22 verses here, if you include the beginning of chapter 11. 12 of those verses describe the effect on Daniel himself. Verse 8 is typical. I was left alone and saw this great vision, and no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. Somebody's paraphrased it. I became a sorry figure of a man. And the emphasis throughout is on Daniel's physical and psychological weakness, that which results from this encounter with this visionary figure. And the process is repeated in verse 10. The hand touches him and gets him standing, rather trembling on his, well, not exactly standing, he's trembling on his hands and knees, but at least he's up from being face down on the ground. And the man speaks, and then in verse 15 we find that he's turned towards the ground again. And in verse 16, he's saying, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me, I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. The effect of this vision is overwhelming. And it is all the more striking when we remember that the vision is actually of a servant of God, not a vision of God himself. Now, this is absolutely normal. If you know your Bible, you'll know that this is what invariably follows when somebody has a genuine vision of God or something very near to it, as Daniel does. It doesn't seem to happen in the Hollywood movies, does it? When there's some kind of appearance of God in the Hollywood movies, it's an excuse for the latest special effects. There are no special effects here. The real thing is very different. And it's always that way. Remember Isaiah in the temple in chapter 6, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his robe filled the temple, and the seraphim circling round the throne of God and calling to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. It's not how people necessarily think about the living God. Holy, 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 they cry as they circle round his throne. A modern rewriting of that vision would expect them to be saying, love, love, love is the Lord of hosts. But they don't. They sing, holy, holy, holy. And Isaiah says, woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips. The thing that is his greatest gift, his ability to speak, is actually contaminated. The prophet's lips are unclean. And he says, I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, and I have seen the King. And likewise, the Apostle Paul sees Jesus, the risen Jesus. It's not a sort of experience. He actually encounters the risen Jesus on the Damascus Road, and he falls to the ground, and he's blind for 3 days until Ananias of Jerusalem comes and prays for him to receive his sight. Daniel's God, likewise, is one, as somebody says, of a glorious holiness that blazes with fire. His is a scarcely bearable presence, even for those who love and serve him. The American pastor, John MacArthur, talks of a man he knew, used to come and talk to him, and this chap would come to Pastor MacArthur and say that he often had visions of Jesus. And he says things like, Jesus often comes and stands next to me and talks to me even while I'm shaving. And MacArthur said, so do you stop shaving? And it'd be hard to imagine Daniel carrying on shaving in the presence of this vision of this heavenly man. It is overwhelming because God is glorious and his glory is mediated through this angelic being, and Daniel is just a man. It's overwhelming, but do note it is not crippling. How important it is to see that as well. Because though he falls, in verse 9, on his face in deep sleep with his face to the ground, the next thing that happens is that a gracious hand touches him and lifts him up. Same happens to the Apostle John in Revelation chapter 1. So here is Daniel knocked out by what he's seen, but he's not left there. He's not knocked down in order to be knocked out. He's knocked down and lifted up. A hand touched me and set me on my hands and knees. That's the grace of God at work. And as well as the gracious hand, there is the gracious word. The first thing that he says, verse 11, this man says, O Daniel, you are a man greatly loved, highly esteemed. God delights in you. He chooses to do so. You're a man greatly loved. Fear not, verse 12, the next thing. Do not fear. There is a right and a proper fear of God. And Daniel expresses that as he falls in deep sleep with his face to the ground. But there is a wrong fear. Fear him, you saints, and you will then have nothing else to fear, says that hymn. Fear not, Daniel. Verse 12, and then in verse 19, even stronger, he says, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong and of great courage. Such are the ways of our God with his servants. We are rightly overwhelmed by his glory, or should be, but in the Lord Jesus Christ we too are greatly loved. God delights in the children whom he has brought into his family. And we too are reassured by his gracious words, and we stand up on our feet at his gracious invitation. So this is an overwhelming vision. Spend a disproportionate amount of time on it, I suppose. But we need to see it and feel it for ourselves. And doesn't it make you marvel again at the incarnation? At God made man in Jesus Christ, that this is the God whom we detect here, who becomes in due time a baby in his own world, totally unthreatening, absolutely needy, needing his bottom wiped like any other dependent newborn child. The grace of God in the incarnation is quite extraordinary, and we see that all the more as we glimpse the glory of God in Daniel's vision. Well, we must move on. If the vision is overwhelming, the second thing we find here is that Daniel's prayer is crucial. Prayer is crucial. You'll have noticed this perhaps in verse 12, where we are told very plainly that the vision came in answer to Daniel's extended prayer. Verse 12, he said to me, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourselves before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words." His prayer is crucial, and the vision wouldn't have happened, the help wouldn't have come, if Daniel had himself not prayed as he did. And the content of his context of his praying is described at the beginning. Verse 2, in those days I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. And it is plain that he is deeply in prayer, seeking God with the utmost seriousness at this time. He is in mourning. Why is he in mourning? Because of the deep concern that he has about the future of God's people. We remember 50,000 have gone home, but since going home they've been met with unrelenting opposition. The euphoria has gone. It's evaporated. And euphoria does, doesn't it, when there's a big change on the national, international level. You remember the Arab Spring? It all seemed so fresh and exciting to begin with, but it didn't last. Some of us may stretch back to 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the collapse of the Soviet Union and one country after another, and the new world order that we were promised by the American president. The euphoria didn't last very long. Some of us may even stretch back to 1945 and the wonder of the end of the great Second World War. But these things give deep concern about what actually takes place of what had been there before. And that's why Daniel is mourning. He's mourning over the waywardness, the ongoing waywardness of the people who have not learnt the lessons of the exile. He mourns over the threats that they face from opponents back home. And so he carries this concern repeatedly for the full 3 weeks, he says, to the throne of heaven. With disciplined diet, no delicacies, he's totally taken up with this concern. And in doing so, in praying in this way, the rest of the chapter shows that as he does so, he finds that he's much more than just a man on his knees. By engaging with God in intercessory prayer, he becomes a player in what is going on in the supernatural realm, behind what is seen, behind the scenes. Now, we've seen this before, but we see it again here. A contemporary news reporter would just bring reports and stories of what was seen in the Middle East of the day. He would refer to vast movements of people, shifting power structures. He'd write about the rise and fall of rulers and empires and so on. But there is a greater unseen reality behind what is visible to everybody. There is a heavenly counterpart to the earthly struggles that the people of God face on the face of the earth. And Israel is a very, very small, beleaguered little nation. But we find up in the, when you get to the heavenly places, that you have spiritual powers on your side, and they are immense. And the man in the vision explains this to Daniel, as he talks about the kind of diabolical opposite number with whom he, the man in the vision, has struggled. And at the end of the chapter, the warfare continues. And in that warfare, Daniel has his part to play. God has ordered it that way, with the sweat and the Spartan diet and the agony of soul that is involved. And we might think, well, if God is God, why doesn't he just do what he wants to do? Why can he not just say to the opposing spiritual powers, hands off my people and have done with it? Why does he have to stir up Daniel's praying to accomplish his will? Well, the fact is he does sometimes just say hands off. You remember Balaam and Balak in Numbers chapter 22? God's people are under threat, but they know nothing about the threat at all. But God knows and sees and puts an invisible shield around them of which they themselves are entirely unaware. And maybe he does that for you and me more often than we ever know. So God does sometimes do that, maybe more often than we know, but he still calls us to pray as he called Daniel to do. We're enlisted in the warfare which is going on in the heavenly places. Because the real enemies that God's people face today are not Boko Haram or the Islamic State, or nearer to home, they're not even the National Secular Society. It's much nearer to us as we pray and mourn over our own country. No, the real enemies that we face are the principalities and powers behind them, as Ephesians 6 elaborates. And the weapons of our warfare, like Daniel's, are not worldly, but have divine power to bring down strongholds. So we must use them. Daniel's prayer is crucial, and the vision wouldn't have happened, and he wouldn't have got involved in the same way had he not prayed. Speeding on, very briefly, faithfulness, thirdly, is hard. This chapter teaches us that as well. Faithfulness to God's purpose and call is a hard thing. And if anyone's not yet responded, is with us this morning to the call of Jesus Christ, we need to realize that it's a wonderful thing. It is a hard one. Daniel is a very faithful servant, and his faithfulness is costly. And we see that in verse 1, where a word is revealed to Daniel, and the word is true. And it is a great conflict, which might mean that it's hard to understand. More likely, Daniel is told that the conflict going on will be great, and it will take its toll in his own experience. Now, at this point, he's way beyond retirement age. He could surely have opted out if he'd wanted to. Life wasn't bad in Babylon by this stage. He's an old man. He could leave everything else to others, enjoy a comfortable retirement. We might say, after all, Daniel had been through a lot. Think of all those lions you had to cope with, other pressures you've had to face. Time to put your feet up. You've earned it, mate. But he won't. He is faithful to the end. And he shows that by identifying deeply with the people of God. He's very concerned for those he does not see anymore, but who've gone back home and are struggling. He identifies with the suffering people of God elsewhere. And you and I do very well to do the same, living as we do in relatively comfortable Tunbridge worlds. We do well to stay in touch with at least one part of the world where God's people are struggling in a harder place. If we get the Barnabas Fund newsletters or in prayer news for some missionary organization, we need to do that if we're to imitate Daniel's faithfulness at this point. Christian life was always going to be costly. And Daniel, by sharing in the needs of God's people further afield, experiences himself as he carries their pain in his prayer, something of what that cost involves. But discipleship is about faithfulness, inward discipline, outward pain, but wonderfully worth it for the sake of following Christ. The sort of anemic God that so many people seem to believe in today, the one who is so soft and tolerant that he'd never dream of contradicting anyone, let alone judging them, that sort of God will never inspire faithfulness in a follower. That kind of God will never cause anyone to make sacrifices for his sake. But Daniel's God is worth living for, and if necessary, dying for. And for us, he is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, and who assures us that faithfulness, though costly, will be met with a vast reward. What greater reward could there be than to be brought into God's purposes and entrusted with his confidences, as Daniel is here? The vision is overwhelming, his prayer is crucial, his faithfulness is costly, and history, lastly, is very complex. And this really is the stuff of chapter 11, so we'll pick up on that next time. But it's just worth noting from chapter 10 that something about the ongoing battle, which is the story of human history, that though the sovereign God is indeed Lord of all, it seems there is a certain contingency in the way things work out. This heavenly man, we remember, says that he couldn't get to Daniel's aid as fast as he wanted to. He was delayed for 21 days. There's some kind of frustration in the heavenly places, even as there is on earth. And maybe that's what the Apostle Paul is referring to when he says to the Thessalonian Christians, "We wanted to come to see you again and again, but Satan hindered us." But even if that is the case in some way, the result can only ever be a delay. And even the delay is contained within the purpose of God, and the ultimate victory is guaranteed. History is complex, but even Satan's most strenuous activity, somebody has said, cannot overthrow God's purposes or do lasting harm to God's people. And we know that in his universe there are rebels, but there are no rivals. And Daniel's role, like yours and mine, is to trust and to pray and to stand firm.